All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuck sticks? What the fucksters? What the fuckstables? What the fuckleberry fins? It's Mark Maron. This is WTF. Welcome to my show. Thank you for listening. If you're new here, feel free to pick up the free app and upgrade to premium. And there's about 450 some odd shows you can stream into your brains. You can do that at WTFpod.com. The show's doing well. I'm so glad IFC's happy with the show. Whoa, something just fell off the wall. What the fuck? What is that? See, now, this is how I know I'm perhaps not in a great mental space. And I'm, again, not complaining, but something just fell off the wall. It was the, it was an animation cell of me on Dr. Katz, just out of nowhere, fell off the wall. Why did that happen right then? What does it mean that my animated self has fallen off the wall during a monologue where I was about to talk about not feeling great? Does that, is that some sort of sign? Maybe what it's saying is to drop the pretense if there is any left. Get past it, Maron. Get past whatever this facade of what you think is the appealing part of you. Let's go deeper, if that's possible. Perhaps that's what it's saying, or else it just fell off the wall. I can put it up. I can put it back later. Today on the show, Giovanni Ribisi is on the show. He's in that movie, A Million Ways to Die in the West. And I got to talk to him for an hour. I like the way that guy acts. He's a great actor. I was nervous about talking to him. Sometimes actors, you don't know what's going to happen. Got nothing against actors, but you don't know. But he seems to have a life. I don't know. I think he's a great actor. So he'll be here in a minute. But let's get down to brass tacks, since the animated me has fallen off the wall. Okay. So here's what I need to know, I guess. I think I need to buy some shit. All right. Look, I'm not a millionaire. I'm not necessarily wealthy. I save money. I don't buy much, but I think maybe it's time to buy things. I almost went and bought a new car. Do I need a new car? No. Does anyone need a new car? Not usually. But maybe that would make me happy. But am I that guy? See, that's the problem. Like, I'm the kind of guy, like, I feel happiest knowing that I have money that I'm not spending. I think you call that a Jew. No, that's hacky. I'm the kind of guy that just, I'd rather just know I have money. So if I run out of money, I'll have money. Does that make sense? So maybe it's harder to run out of money. But now I'm thinking, like, fuck it, man. Okay, I'll tell you what I did. I got a little extravagant, and it made my life better. I'm going to be honest with you. Okay? And I don't want you to judge me. But I went to IKEA, and I bought two sets of curtains for my bedroom. Two sets of curtains for my bedroom and a new shower curtain. Yeah, I went crazy. And do you know how fucking easy it was? You guys knew about those curtains in my bedroom. LaFonda had shred them. They were sad. They were faded. They were from when my wife lived with me, and it was just depressing. It looked like an immobile old lady's home, where she just could, like, where you walk in, and you're like, Grandma, what? Oh, someone's got to change Grandma's curtains. So I did that, and they're beautiful. And then I changed the shower curtain again that had been there since my wife lived here. And I'm not the kind of guy that thinks that I'm holding on to stuff from that time or lending it any significance. But I'm starting to think that that's maybe what's been holding me back. Maybe that's part of my problem. Maybe there's still some part of my heart that's hung up on that woman. So I changed the curtains. I was just laying in bed thinking, like, oh my God, I love my curtains so much. And you know how much those curtains cost me? For the two sets of them, $20. Shower curtain was like $14. And it changed my fucking life. Now, this isn't a commercial for IKEA. This is a commercial for maybe sometimes it's nice to buy you something nice. And that wasn't even that nice. But now I'm like, I'm going to buy a car. Can't buy that at IKEA. They don't make any, you could assemble a car, those little wrenches. I bought a car at IKEA, just sitting in your driveway, frustrated with directions and an Allen wrench. There's something wrong with the carburetor. It's not running. Does that door? I think I put that door on the wrong side. Wait a minute. This is supposed to be the front of the car. God damn IKEA cars. I don't know where Def Black Cat is. I'm not going to call it. I'm not going to call it a life on Def Black Cat, but I haven't seen him in about a week. And that upsets me because he's my fucking spirit animal. What the fuck do you do when your spirit animal splits? I can't just get a new spirit animal. I'm not that, you know, I'm very monogamous when it comes to spirit animals. I don't know how many more tickets are still available for the June 14th, first annual, 26th annual Onion AV Club Comedy Festival in Chicago, but I'll be there. I'm sure there are tickets left for the Lawrence Arts Center in Lawrence, Kansas, Tuesday, June 24th. Wednesday, June 25th, I'll be at the Firebird in St. Louis. Thursday through Saturday, 26th through 28th, I'll be at the Comedy Addict in Bloomington. That's Indiana. On Friday, August 1st, I'll be at the Austin 360 Amphitheater with the Oddball Festival. On Saturday, August 2nd, I'll be at the JEXA Energy Pavilion in Dallas with the Oddball Festival. On Sunday, August 3rd, I'll be at the Cynthia Woods Mitchell Pavilion in Houston, Texas for the Oddball Festival. On Friday, August 6th, I'll be in Mid-Florida Credit Union Amphitheater in Tampa. Whew, haven't been back to Tampa lately. Last night, I snapped on stage. Have not done that in a while. Snapped on stage full on. Full on. I've been doing sets at the Comedy Store. I did three sets there on Friday. Beautiful. Had a great time. Last night, I was in the main room. Beautiful set. Then I go in the OR. I'm second up. Audience is still pretty fresh. They're just in. First guy goes up. He does pretty good. But there, you know, I get up there and there's some fucking chatter going on stage left, and I see it's some big doofus motherfucker and his dumb drunk wife and another couple, you know, just in, you know, I feel it immediately, man. I know what's going on. This guy doesn't give a fuck. He's still settling in kind of, but he's been there the whole time. You know, they're not really paying attention to the show. They probably went out to dinner. They're probably a little drunky. They're talking too loud. I go, can we stop that? Can we stop, please? And then I keep talking, and it's like only half a room at this point, so it's distracting. They keep talking. I'm like, really, shut the fuck up. I don't want to lose my mind. Do you want to stay in this room? Like, I'm not even going to indulge this shit. And this guy goes, he made some dumb joke that no one laughed at, something about an inflatable girlfriend. I don't fucking know. And I'm like, are you going to shut your fucking mouth, or are you going to have to leave? What's going to happen here? Because it's the beginning of the show, and there's no worse a heckler than some big, dumb motherfucker that thinks he's funny and thinks that he has a right, that he's entitled to talk and fuck the show up. I was livid, and I just unleashed. And I was being quite nice at the beginning of the set, and then it was sort of like, okay, now you see it. You just saw the monster. How's everybody doing? Everybody okay? How's that for you? But they were on my team. They were on my side, and somehow or another, I pulled it back around. But it always sort of concerns me in that moment. When that type of rage comes out so quickly I just can't stand the lack of respect for stand-up sometimes. And I felt kind of bad, because you feel kind of like shaky after that. You know, you feel sort of like you just did something wrong. But it felt so right. The other comics seem to be happy. It's hard. You don't see as much snapping as you used to, because there's a job security issue at a certain level. You know, people want to snap, but you can't snap because you don't want people, you know, the club owners or whoever to go, I don't know if you're going to come back because that was a little bit much, but I don't give a fuck. So I'd like to think I schooled that guy, but knowing that guy, whoever that guy is who engages people like that, he was just thrilled to have the attention no matter how it came at him. Fuck that. Let's talk to Giovanni Ribisi, and he's in that movie A Million Ways to Die in the West, which I'm yet to see.
I could open up my shirt. Holy shit.
Iggy Pop did it shirtless, so that precedent has been set.
Oh, good.
Shirtless podcasting has happened. I have broadcasted from this chair naked before. That's happened. So there's...
By yourself, or were there...
No, other... just by myself. I've not crossed that line of actual nude podcasting. Giovanni Ribisi.
No.
Yes.
I'm changing it.
Now, how can you change that amazing name?
Giovanni Ribisi.
What? How do you pronounce it? Do you pronounce it with an Italian flair?
I mean, I guess so. It's in between an English and an Italian... Yeah, dialect, I guess.
Do you have
Giovanni?
Yeah.
Like you say Joe and then Vanni.
Yeah. Does anyone say it like that?
People say Vanni.
Yeah, hey, but Vanni, in your family though, do you have Italian family members?
Yeah, my father, he's Italian, Sicilian.
Really?
Well, he's not from Sicily. My great grandfather moved over to. It's not really interesting.
It is. But it's all this show's about.
It moved over from Sicily, just outside of Palermo, over to San Jose.
He came from the. He didn't go through New York.
No.
He ended up, he just went to San Jose, California.
California, yeah. Farmers, you know, they come from Sicilian farmers.
Uh-huh.
I think he wanted to get away from certain things out there.
In Sicily?
Yeah, I found it. I actually don't know if I would actually get into trouble for even, I don't know.
What?
I found out that I actually have family that are in, you know, they're in jail and they were, you know.
Mafia related?
Yeah, as you would expect.
In Sicily.
Like, you've seen the movies.
Sure.
Yeah.
Like the original mob, yeah, the Black Hand.
Yeah, but we're four generations away from that.
So it's got to be okay.
Yeah, it's okay.
We'll see.
It's bragging rights. Well, yeah. Not really, but how do you brag? No, that's terrible.
But they're like,
I mean, cinematically, it's bragging rights.
Sure.
I guess.
It seems like an interesting backstory.
Sort of.
It seems like the possibility for. You can manufacture an entire mythology for yourself.
Yeah, I have, believe me, several times every day. Every morning I wake up and, what am I? Who am I today?
Well, you do that though, man. I mean, you get into some parts.
Yeah, I guess so, right? That's my job. I forgot about that. That is my job. I feel like that's one of those things you wake up every day and you kind of realize, oh my God, that's what I do. And that's a different facet of that.
And not only have you been doing it, not only do you do it, but you've been doing it like your whole fucking life.
Yeah, how do you avoid that? How do you avoid that when you're growing, you know, you're a young kid in the 70s with Star Wars and all that? And
how old are you?
I'll be 40 this year. 40.
Just 40. I turned 40. 50 this year.
Wow, you look like a good 50.
Thank you very much.
Strong 50.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
I don't know how that's possible.
50.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have children. Maybe that's it.
No, I don't know. I have a daughter. I have a beautiful daughter. She's 17 years old in August.
17 years old?
Yeah.
So you had her when you were 23?
22, yeah.
Really?
22, yeah.
Was that on purpose?
Ultimately, of course, you go to the hospital and you're doing it with the intention.
You know what's going to happen.
You know what's going to happen, yeah, exactly. She's just an incredible person.
Yeah?
Turned out okay? Turned out okay. Smart as a whip.
Mm-hmm.
She'll kick my ass.
Are you still with her mom or is that behind you?
No, but... No, but we're good friends, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, you really don't have a choice in that situation.
That's true.
You have a kid. You gotta. It's about the kid, and it's not about.
You have to. Right.
You know, whatever.
Right. You have to figure out a way.
Yeah.
You have to figure out a way to be pleasant.
Man, that's a country record right there.
You got to figure out a way to love you.
God damn it.
Your whole life was here.
Yeah, born and raised in Los Angeles. I was born and raised.
I don't know if I know that many people that have that.
Yeah, I don't know. It's becoming more and more predominant, I guess. But it's true. There's a lot of people. So it is this melting pot, you know, a lot of people. And that's good. I mean, that's, I guess, the one cultural flag or pennant that we can wave around a little bit, sort of, not really. I mean, I guess New York is a similar situation.
Well, New York seems to have, like, you know, like, born in New York, it means something like, yeah, you're a New Yorker. Born in L.A., it's like, who the fuck is born in L.A.?
Meaningless. It's a ghost town. If you're born in L.A. and you live in L.A., you're a ghost, you know? Why do you live here? Are you from here originally?
No, I grew up in New Mexico, originally from Jersey.
Yeah.
And then, I lived in New York for years. I had enough of it, and I came out here because show business was out here.
Yeah.
And then they wouldn't have me. Mm-hmm. So eventually I moved into my garage. This is where I live now.
Holland Park.
This is the universe.
Great.
This is how it worked out for me.
Great neighborhood. I have a lot of friends that are living out here, moving out here.
What part of town did you grow up in?
I was born and raised in North Hollywood. I mean, I was born in Hollywood, raised in North Hollywood.
Right.
And then I was a different North Hollywood when I was younger.
Like
I'm 40.
How?
You know, just running from gangbangers and things like that in the street.
Really?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, you know, I don't know. And then there's NoHo. You know,
yeah, sure.
Which is
it's a real estate term for, like, we can make it more expensive here.
It's a real estate term. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I'm not even sure where North Hollywood is. So just over the hill on the other side, it's like just at the edge of the valley, right off the one.
So you 170.
Yeah.
You get off at Burbank Boulevard or Magnolia.
Okay. Yeah.
And then you go deeper, Oxnard, Van Nuys, and all that.
That was a dicey neighborhood?
Used to be, yeah. I mean, yeah, it used to be, you know, there was FFF, Fight for Freedom. That was the gang.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, break dancing was big. I was a little 9-year-old breaker.
Yeah, you had your cardboard box
and my jumpsuit. I remember these guys. They came up to me. Yeah. I was walking. My mother had gotten me for Christmas or my birthday. They're really close to each other. A breaking outfit, And it was, I think it was literally breaking. The movie came out, and
right.
so it was gray and light blue. And I was walking down to the 7-Eleven, and these guys walked up to me and said, "Hey, are you a breaker?"
Yeah.
And I was like, "No, yeah." And they said, "Hey, break for me."
Uh-huh.
And I and it was literally like that scene in Fame when she's taking her shirt off, crying in the audition scene. Oh, I was like break dancing.
You had no choice.
Break dancing, crying in front of these guys, and I did kind of that the wave with my arm.
Yeah, yeah.
And I pointed at one of them. They said they laughed, and then I kept walking. And then they threw their peach at me.
Oh, they were assholes after all.
And they hit me, and they ruined my breaking outfit last time I wore it. Then my mother got me another outfit.
Mm-hmm.
My mother in her outfits. She got me a sleeveless what's it called?
Tank top.
Tank top. No, for sweatshirt.
Okay.
And it was gray, sort of like tie-dye looking gray, and mm-hmm. it said, "Just go for it," slanted cursive with an exclamation point at the end.
What was your mom trying to do to you?
I don't know, man.
What happened in that?
I really almost got beat up for it.
For what?
Just go for it.
For being a what? For what? Did someone say
the
you?
Bully. Yeah.
You're a bully. Pussy.
Yeah, exactly. What are you, a pussy? And I was like, no. And then Fame again, all over, taking the shirt off.
Over and over again. Yeah. Those were the tough knocks.
Yeah, exactly.
But when you were growing up, I mean, was your dad was in show business?
Mm-hmm. He was my dad is a musician, and that's where I learned how to, you know, we would have the Bama Jammas out in the backyard and all that.
Oh, yeah? What's he play?
Well, not really in the backyard. But that's what they do in Alabama.
Sure.
He plays everything. He was in one of those one hit wonder bands.
Which one?
Called People.
Uh-huh.
Out of the Bay Area.
Oh, really?
And they had a song called "I Love You." It was a Zombies B side, and they, you know, they did that. And he's an amazing musician. He's really he's an erudite with that. You know,
like a psychedelic hit though. Was it like a pop psychedelic?
Yeah,
thing?
It was kind of like that 1968,
right?
One hit wonder song. Uh-huh. You know,
and the Zombies covered it.
No, the Zombies they covered the. It was a Zombies song.
Oh, okay.
And they covered
okay.
it. Yeah,
yeah.
And you know, so I grew up. You know, he brought home a Dan Electro. I think when I was 4 years old or something like
uh-huh.
that. And then, and you know, that just music was all over. It was all over the house. And yeah, he was in show business, you know. But he, you know, Bay Area, L.A. was plastic land.
Oh, really? So, like, wait, so, but he didn't, he lived down here, so he'd go up to San Francisco?
No. I mean, he was from, you know, the Sicilians mm-hmm. came over.
San Jose.
Yeah, San Jose, Bay Area, you know.
So he was there during the beautiful 60s.
Yeah, the beautiful 60s.
The mind-blowing
60s.
Time.
Yeah, exactly.
But what did he do, like production, or he played studio musician?
No,
or?
he was the keyboardist in the band. And
oh,
then,
so he stayed in the band for a while.
Oh, yeah, he was in the band.
They lasted a while?
Around. Oh, yeah, they played with, I think they played with everybody. They played with Janis Joplin, you know, he has all these stories about seeing Jimi Hendrix.
Wow.
And yeah, I mean, he's just incredible.
He's still around though?
My dad, yeah.
He still plays?
We're really good friends. We see each other every day.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, sometimes. He's more into electronic stuff now, you know, like things that you can do on your iPad. And all that.
And your parents are still together?
No, they're not together.
Oh, yeah?
No, that's the thing, man. You don't stay married.
It's hard, right?
No, I mean, it's not like a thing that you try to do anymore. It's just like you get divorced.
Have you been divorced?
I've been divorced. Yeah.
Well, I didn't know if you guys were married.
Oh yeah. So yeah, divorced. You know,
I've been divorced twice, and I have no kids.
It's the thing, man.
It's sad
it's
though.
It's what you do. It is sad. It's horrible.
Horrible.
It's horrible.
So you married a second time?
Oh yeah.
Uh huh. How long have you been married this time?
I love my wife. I love my wife.
Good.
2 years. Yeah.
2 years. So that's good. You should be happy.
Yeah. Yeah.
if there's problems at two, no. It's not gonna.
Yeah. Right.
But you waited a while.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I did. I mean, I was never, someone who was, you know, extremely, I don't know. I think I'm a relationship guy.
Yeah.
I guess
me too. I'm a relationship it's nice guy. To have somebody there to absorb whatever you're putting out nice for worse, better or for worse.
Yeah, exactly. Said in the most selfish way.
Yeah.
Absorb me.
Yeah. Yeah. Please absorb me. I'm overflowing. I need someone to absorb me. I need some help here. Cool. So when did you start what was the acting thing? Clearly your mother was supporting your your need to be theatrical.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, she wasn't. She, you know, I was 4 years old, and it was the '70s, and I was living in Los Angeles, and it was, you know, it was possible. It was everywhere. You know, you can't go anywhere here without, you know, bumping it. You know, being
industry town.
Yeah, and then finally, a friend of ours down the street got an agent.
Mm-hmm.
Three doors down, of course, you know, and if you would have looked the other way, the person three doors down would have had an agent as well. And so, you know, that was my, after 5 years, you know, that was my thing where I was like, come on, if they're doing it. And she was really great. She was really supportive and kind of incredible, in that way. And it was on and off, and you're forced this sort of this premature maturation of being in a professional world and in a professional.
When did you first start working?
I was nine or 10 years old. I did a Unocal. It was right when Union 76 turned into Unocal, and now they're just 76. And I did a Unocal 76 commercial.
That was your first gig.
Yeah, that was my first.
And you were 10.
Kids, you know, I don't know what it's like now, but you know, there's less child actors.
Right,
just because of what it is, and so, you know, we would have literally five auditions a day all right. over the city. You know, Culver City, go back to Studio City.
When you were 10,
yeah, and my mother drove me around for all of that. She drove me around. I mean, we would get home at 8 o'clock at night, and it was something that I was driving her. I was definitely wanting to do it. You know,
like, right?
You know.
And you have another. You have brothers and sisters.
I have a twin sister.
Right,
yeah.
That's twins. Right, right, yeah. Right.
And then I have a younger sister.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you were the only actor at that time.
Yeah, and then of course it sort of, you know, seeped its way over to the other members of my family and my other siblings. And my sister, she was in a movie when we were 16. She was in a movie called Dazed and Confused.
Yeah, I love that movie.
Yeah, she's the redhead.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. What is that? He says, "Hey, Red, you need a ride," and she says, "No, I got one." She's in her car.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then my younger sister is just really like almost savantish with accents and dialects and voices. So she was doing voiceover for a while.
So when do you first start doing legitimate? You did a commercial. And then, like, it picks up? You just start doing everything?
Yeah, I remember my first sort of thing was this TV show called The New Leave It to Beaver. No, it's not.
So you did a couple of bit parts, but this was the big payoff.
It's not a porno.
Yeah.
It was a cable TV show. When cable was like, you know?
Yeah.
But so they were doing this cable TV show. And I remember we had six auditions, and it came down to me and this one other kid.
Yeah.
And then we were both sitting there in the audition all day, going in and out, and then we would go in, and I would read. Well, I would go in, I would read, and then he would go in, and he would read. And,
right.
And that happened six times in and of itself. And then came home and playing out on the lawn, and I remember, you know, my mother walking out and saying, you didn't get the part.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't get the part, and I was awful. And
she was the one that would break the news to you every time.
Yeah, I mean, she was just really honest. You know, it was a thing, and you know, in retrospect, it was a good thing. It was a life lesson. It was not this sort of thing that we have in our modern day youth culture of entitlement and all mm-hmm. that. It was just kind of like, whoosh, that's yeah. what life is.
You didn't get it, kid.
Yeah.
Suck it up.
Yeah, but then they gave me the part of the friend on
right.
it. And so that was the thing. And I was...
Was that Eddie Haskell?
Yeah, it was a similar character okay. to the Eddie Haskell yeah. guy. And I didn't do it good. I didn't even know what the fuck is Eddie Haskell, right?
No, who knows? Yeah. I don't even know. I just don't.
Well, he was a nice guy, though. The actual guy, Eddie Haskell, was on the show, and he was really
good. As an adult.
Sweetheart, yeah.
Yeah. yeah.
And Jerry Mathers and,
right,
and everybody.
Right, right.
And, you know, I don't know. It was just, you know, we shot at Universal Studios.
Exciting.
And it was like a whole thing.
Yeah.
And I remember going from that into other television shows, and then puberty struck, and I was just like, fuck this. I don't, you know, tie-dye jeans and the whole thing. And I was really into music at the time, and I didn't want to do it anymore.
You didn't want to do TV?
TV? No, I didn't want, you know.
You were done with acting.
I had a friend who turned to me, and I looked up to this guy. He was like the cool guy.
Yeah.
And I looked up to him, and he came down to visit me on a TV show that I was doing called My Two Dads, and he said, you hate this, don't you? And I was like, I guess I do. I guess I do. Yes, I hate this. And that sort of tripped me into, you know, this thing. And then finally, I don't know, am I boring you? I don't know.
No, I love it.
No, well, I, and then finally, there was another friend of mine 2 years later who told me about an actor by the name of Marlon Brando.
Sure.
And
you're like what, 14, 13?
16.
You're 16 and you had no.
Yeah, and I saw Streetcar Named Desire and The Fugitive Kind, this great movie.
Yep.
With Anna Magnani and Joanne Woodward and Marlon Brando. And it really just changed me. And I started studying acting, and then I fell in love with, you know, with acting, but really movies, you know. In a way that was different from just wanting, you know, the LA thing.
So previous to that, this happens in the middle of shooting My Two Dads.
We were done with My Two Dads.
So you did like 30 episodes of My Two Dads.
I guess so, yeah.
And then this guy, you've hit the wall as a 16-year-old child actor.
Yeah, trying to grow my hair out. You know, heavy metal was big, and I'm a guitar player at that time. And all I wanted to do was shred. All I wanted to
who
do
are your
was
bands?
Shred. Van Halen.
Yeah.
You know, of course, which I think is still. I still
he can really
amazing.
Play. Yeah.
Sabbath? I mean, when I was 13, it was like, you know, it was like Yngwie Malmsteen.
Oh, really?
Oh, so, yeah. It was like
top-notch noodlers.
Yeah, noodlers. Yeah.
Math guitar.
Exactly. Math guitar. Yeah. Yngwie Malmsteen. Yeah. And then who else? Paul Gilbert was another.
Were you a Zappa fan?
Huge Zappa fan.
Really? So you were full-on guitar nerd.
I mean, that was like, you know, Steve Vai started in Zappa. Yeah.
Yep. But at that time, you were like, you know, fuck this. Because I imagine that being on a sitcom, especially if you're listening to music that's elevated, at some point, even as a kid, you got to be like, this is bullshit.
Yeah. I mean, that was the thing. I think so. I think it was hanging out with people that, you know, there was also another thing that was starting to happen, which was the independent, the third wave of independent films, and you know, Quentin Tarantino, and all of that, and
right.
You know, the Lemleys opened up,
right,
and you start. There's this sort of confluence of me, you know, discovering Marlon Brando, and then Robert De Niro, and I remember Cape Fear came out, and that was really
so you huge. Locked into the idea,
and
of
there was like this confluence of going, oh, there's something deeper than just, you know, gee, Wally, I don't know, Beef.
Yeah, right. Well, obviously. So that all hit you at once, and you locked into the method thing that fascinated you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was definitely
because
part of it.
Because you feel like that kind of actor to me.
Well, you know, I don't know. And I think it's now, I don't know, I don't really know, that's fallen so out of fashion because of, I think the way it's been such a misinterpretation of what that acting technique really is, which is really just sort of founded in and just try to be as committed as you can.
Who'd you study with?
A guy named Milton Katsalas.
Uh-huh.
Milton Katsalas, who's no longer around.
This is at 16. You were like, I'm gonna lay into this.
16, yeah. And you know, and then
was he a big guy?
Was he a
respected guy? Like he was one of the dudes? Like who was in your class?
Yeah, he was. There were a lot of people. He did have a master class that I weaseled my way into prematurely, but I did on Saturday mornings for the people that were working. And you saw a lot of character actors in there. There were a lot of people that worked with him.
People I would know.
I think I don't really remember, but I think, you know, George Clooney was there at one point. I think.
Do you remember seeing people going like shit?
I remember seeing actors that I didn't really necessarily know, but I was really blown away. Like it was stuff. Oh, Jeffrey Tambor was there.
Oh my god.
Who really is an amazing person and an amazing actor.
I interviewed him.
Oh, yeah.
He gave me a run for my money.
He did, yeah. He's a smart guy.
Well, he was. We did it live. I don't usually do them live, so we did a one-on-one live, and he fucked with me for a half an hour before he let me.
Wait, so we live versus editing?
You're no, for, like in front of an audience.
Oh, right. Okay.
So we were at South by Southwest, and I got this opportunity, and he was just sort of like, he just fucked with me for half an hour, and I just took it. Yeah. And then finally, he let it, once we figured out how we were going to go at it, he just sort of eased up. But he was amazing. Like some of those, you know, before, everyone knows him as a comedic actor now, but like, and Justice for All.
Oh, are you kidding
holy
me?
Holy shit.
Incredible, yeah.
That was fucking crazy, man.
Yeah, really, really an incredible actor and an incredible teacher as well. He taught when Milton wouldn't teach, he would step in.
So I try to talk to actors about this because, you know, I do a little acting myself, but I come from stand-up. So you obviously had a knack for it. You were, you know, a bona fide child actor that was able to deliver jokes.
And... I didn't have a knack, but I think I had an icon and I wanted to...
What does that mean?
Well, I had an aspiration.
Okay.
And I had to work. I wasn't talented.
But before you found Brando... Yeah. You were
also, you know, that school of thought. It was.
But you were doing TV.
That.
Were you just doing that without any training, just with directors?
Yeah, I mean, I was 10 years old, 11 years old. Yeah, and so it was directors. I remember there was one director who came up to me, and it was sort of an acting lesson where he tried to hypnotize me. I was 11, 10 years old, and it was this thing with Rosanna Arquette and Judge Reinhold, and they weren't getting along. So I was kind of like stuck in the middle. Of the whole
they weren't
thing.
Getting along in real life.
It was violent. It was like, but it was the late 80s, early 90s. Mm-hmm. You know, it was when you could do that because you were so passionate about and so then the director, I think I had to do a dying scene or something to that effect, and he came up to me and started whispering in my ear all these things and putting images in my mind. It was creepy. I'm not gonna make. I won't make two bones about it. It was definitely strange, but it was something that I thought, oh, what is he doing, and why is he doing this, and is he trying to get me to do something that I don't know about? You know, what's that thing that I don't know?
This was a film.
It was a TV movie. I forget the. Oh, I think it was called Promised a Miracle.
Uh huh. So you're in between two fighting actors in real life.
Yeah, I mean, it was heavy, you know, it was heavy.
And he just came up to you and he was trying to give you like sense memory stuff?
Yeah, exactly, yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh.
You know, close your eyes. And
but you're a kid and you know what it is, and you're like, what's this?
Yeah.
Is this?
And then there's another part of me that's like, shut up, come on, you know.
Right, but you were open-minded enough to go like, is this some weird magic?
Make you wonder about it. Make you wonder about it.
So once you walk into Brando and you go into, what's his name, Casales?
Casales.
It's very curious to me, craft, when people talk about acting, because I think a lot of people who are great actors have a knack for it. Mm-hmm. They have a natural presence. I mean, there is a certain gift to it. But when it comes down to training, so you walk into this class expecting to be delivered the grail of method acting. What were some of the first things you learned there?
Well, I walked in and there was a lot. Don't get me wrong. I was definitely not talented. It didn't come to me naturally. It was something that I had to work on. It's interesting because you know that Malcolm McDowell thing where you're, you know, the 10,000 hours
right.
and all that. I mean, and this is something that the younger generation, there's such a different mentality, an escape from spiritualism and you know, just being technology everywhere.
The new generation.
Yeah. But there is something to, you know, I remember we would do on one scene, I think we would work, 40 or 50 hours.
Yeah.
On 10 minutes.
Really?
Yeah.
So that was like for 6 months? Like how often were you going to the class?
Well, it's 3-4 months. Yeah, so I was going 3 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing another TV show at the time.
Which one was that?
Family Album, that was it.
I don't know any of these. I know the Wonder Years.
Yeah.
You were what, a friend on the Wonder Years?
Yeah. So we would do, you know, I was doing a TV show. I was doing, 40 hours a week. I would three scenes. Different scenes simultaneously and auditioning at the same time, and it was, you know, you're just living and breathing it, and it literally you go to sleep and then you go home and you watch movies and study movies and do, you know, and that was, I think, for years, for six, seven, you know, I was at the Playhouse for 12 years, I think. The Milton Gonzalez, I was there, you know.
Yeah.
And it's something that I knew that I specifically, maybe more than others, had to work at. I remember there was a guy, the first class that I had, there was a guy who was running Columbia Studios at the right. time. And they would have guests come in. Who was... Quincy Jones came in.
Uh-huh.
And I remember he told a story, an amazing story, about Miles Davis talking to a saxophone player. I don't remember who it was.
Yeah.
It wasn't Coltrane, but
right.
it was somebody. And he said, you know, do you ever try to play the wrong notes? Do you ever try to play the wrong notes to try to go as far out as possible to do the wrong thing? What's tasteless? What's bad?
Yeah.
And then try to find your way back from that. And I thought, oh, that's so interesting, you know,
yeah.
to do something wrong.
Uh-huh.
And then to figure out what might be beautiful about it or provocative about it.
Uh-huh. You know? That spoke to you somehow?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that, you know, in a general sense, I mean, it was Quincy Jones. It was coming from his mouth. He spoke for 3 hours, I think.
So out of going against the grain and pushing the envelope in probably an uncomfortable direction, that, you know, to have that kind of courage to do that, finding your way back might be the most amazing thing you ever do.
Yeah, right. Yeah, like, thank God. I definitely have jobs that I needed to find my way back from.
But in terms of being... Like, I guess scene study, the idea is to be present, right? And to be, like, when you put together characters, some of them go a little far away from you, but, you know, generally I can see you in them and the ones that I've seen. But emotionally, you've taken some fairly phenomenal risks, you know, on camera.
Hmm.
You know, to get the courage to do that, I imagine that it's just a repetition of being present with your emotions in the moment.
Yeah.
Or am I overreading into it?
I don't know. I think it's overreading. You know, I mean, honestly, there are things that people that I've done, you know, and people come up to me and ask me about it. And I was not, I mean, I wasn't the furthest thing from being present. You know, I don't know. I had to.
Oh, really?
I don't know. You know, yeah. I mean, I don't even know, you know, like, and it
when
depends.
You were dying and saving Sergeant Private Ryan.
Saving
when
Ryan's
when
privates.
You, yeah, when you were dying and saving Ryan's privates, please tell me you were not thinking about what you were going to eat later.
No. Specifically in that, I remember there were some bees around or wasps, and the blood that was on my body was glucose based.
Uh huh.
And so it was pouring out of these holes out of this prosthetic piece that I had to wear on my chest.
Yeah.
And there were tons of bees around me, and I was worried about being stung. And that's what I was thinking about. But there are in film, and this is one of the things that I love about movies, is that there are so many other factors that go into an actor's performance, you know, the overall arc and the scenes and then
right.
down to the moment, where it's the lighting and the editing and the director and the director's sense. And you can have one guy perform one performance in a singular moment and have 50 people direct it, and you'll have 50 different renditions of it.
Right.
You know, of course.
Right.
And that's what's great about it. I mean, it really is, you know, I mean, an editor is a performer, is part of the performance of an actor.
Yeah, it makes all the difference in the world.
Yeah.
Putting that cover together, you don't know what take they're going to use or which.
Exactly.
You know, yeah.
Yeah.
But when you say the difference between generations in terms of the new generation of actor, you know, sort of obsessed and shallow, technological, and that there was a sense of spiritualism, was that about acting or what do you refer to exactly?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, there's just a different set of values, you
uh-huh.
know, and I guess there's this notion, you know, globalization and even that word is almost falling out of vogue. But I think it's more prevalent and
mm-hmm.
more relevant than ever now, you know, especially with these quick sort of, you know, the sociology and social networking and all that. But, you know, I don't know. I think that, you know, I grew up and my parents were of the hippie generation, and that was all about who am I and what am
right.
I and let's alter our minds to try to find something about that.
And was, where did they land? Because they landed in the Church of
Scientology, Hollywood.
Right?
North Hollywood.
Yeah, and, I know.
North Hollywood. Yeah. Oh, you mean Scientology? Yeah, yeah. That my parents were both in are Scientologists and were both, I guess, what you would consider a clerical.
Right.
Within the
church. Came to it later.
I was born into Scientology while they were working.
But they came to it later? Like they came to it in the 70s?
I think early 70s.
Oh, yeah?
Like maybe late 60s. I don't know, actually. But that's where they met. Where they met each other. Yeah, yeah.
Because I, like, you know, as a guy that does some spiritual searching myself and looks for practical solutions, you know, in your life, in terms of spirituality, where does that play? How does that work for you? I mean, what are the things that get you through the day that are directly related to that?
Well, there's a lot of people that ask me about Scientology, and at the end of the day, Scientology is a personal thing,
right?
And the way I personally view it is as a pragmatic philosophy,
uh-huh.
And meaning that. It's not necessarily a set of beliefs that you go around and try to invest, belief into and hope or whatever. It's really something that's sort of, you know, day to day and practical and you know, you would go, for instance, there's it's almost set up like a university or a college. You go uh-huh. and do courses that apply to specific fields of life, and that's it. I think that to that extent or degree, you know, if it is that, then the thing that I would usually say is, if you're curious about it, then you should probably look at it for yourself, you
right?
know? Because you know, as a Scientologist, you come under a lot of criticism and attack, and you are the you know, the object of derision,
right?
And then as on top of that, there's the you know, being an actor and having a modicum of success with that, then it just, you know,
compounds it.
It's like, exponential. So
right.
Whatever, you know, I mean, it.
But
you know,
these are,
I don't
these
care.
Workshops you've gone to all your life, basically, like at different times.
Yeah, and it is that. I mean, it does astound me. I do have to say all of what circumambulates Scientology and what people say who don't know about it, really. I mean, you know, who haven't ever read anything
right.
from Hubbard,
sure.
with, you know, percentages of your income, and I've heard people say there are guns in the closet inside the organization, and all this crazy stuff, or this being harassed
uh-huh.
and all that. And it's really, I mean, just speaking, and again, from my personal experience, it's not true. I mean, it really is. It comes down to reading a book and
yeah.
applying it to your life. And if it helps, then great. I mean, it's really that simple. It really is.
Because I was always wondered, because I've met, there was one time where I did a small part in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I had like a brief scene with somebody who I believe is a Scientologist, but, you know, I don't need to say who it was, but like, I felt that he was looking at me as if I was a problem. And then, like, I did, like, some, not any real research, but it seems that some, in some of the ways that within the literature of Scientology, mm-hmm. that you sort of have to protect yourself from people that are insanely negative. So like,
let me say one thing. I am personally one of the most negative persons I have ever met
so
in
it.
My life. I get it. I mean,
am I wrong though? Because no, I got
people,
paranoid.
I mean, people, anybody,
yeah.
my Scientologist friends and my friends that are not Scientologists, they, it's the thing that it's known about me.
Uh-huh.
I'm not, and no, I, again, it's not that. It's really, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, you are who you are before you're a Buddhist or, you know, a Christian or
mm-hmm.
a Scientologist or whatever. And so people have interpretations of things or whatever that is. And that's that person. It's not Scientology behind them.
Right. But, you know, but I guess the weird thing, I guess the thing that's tricky for people is that, you know, you hear whatever's true or what isn't true, there are certain political dynamics and certain, you know, business dynamics and certain cult-like dynamics that people hear about. And I guess like any other religion, there's different cliques and there's different ways that people use it. But some things might be going on. It's just not going on with you.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there, you know, in all walks of life, you know, I think that you have, you know, in so many, you know, I think I've met people who practice Buddhism, you know, who had some skeletons in the closet.
Sure.
And it's not, the attribution towards the denomination really, I mean, specifically, this is why I say, if you're curious about it, or you know, then
I'm afraid to read the book.
Well, that's the thing. That's interesting. I love that you just said that.
No, because I don't know what page it happens on.
Nothing happens. Yeah. No. I mean, it's really. I don't know. You know. I mean, it's just literature. It's a practical philosophy.
Has there ever been a point in your life where you're like, I'm done with this shit?
No, because it's not for me something that is as regular as that.
Okay.
You know? And it's almost like, here's what it is. It's, you know, if you were to read somebody that you, like a guy that you respect and had some things to say about sociology or
right.
about studying, you know, subjects, whatever, or about, marriage or
right.
about communication and all that. And there were interesting, smart things that you could use in your life.
Sure.
And that's really what it is. So for instance, you know, I don't know if you've studied philosophy before.
A little bit. Yeah, sure. No, I'm a curious guy.
Yeah. So if you had, you know, if you know, totally different, but you know, Aristotle might say something that,
sure.
you know, that applies to your
yeah,
life
yeah, yeah, yeah.
or whatever. And then that sticks with you and you're able to use that.
Sure.
And that's what it is.
It's a tool.
Yeah. And that's it. And it really is. There's nothing's going to jump out and worm itself into your mind and you're not going to be hypnotized by a bunch of words on
but
a page.
There are different, like, and like I'm not in any way defensive or prodding, and
I have nothing on talking about it. Absolutely.
but only because like you're saying is that, you know, you grew up in it, so you have your relationship with it is relatively passive. Right? I mean, cuz it seems to me that within any belief system, there are fanatics, and there are people that are a lot more committed.
I mean, I know fanatics with the fucking iPhone, you know,
sure.
that are like, I mean, you know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, I guess it definitely is a different thing, but I don't know. I mean, there are certain things.
No,
know,
yeah, but
Facebook.
Like, there's different levels of, like, you know, I guess I'm coming from a place of ignorance mm-hmm. in that, you know, there are different levels of belief. There is a mythology to it as well that you either can take or leave, correct?
I don't know. Not for me.
Right.
For me, yeah. I guess there are, you know, there are people who work for the church.
Right.
And there are people that don't.
Right.
And there are people that attend and the you know, and classes and
uh-huh.
do courses.
Yeah.
And then there's also another factor where there's counseling and all that. And I guess, I mean, different levels of belief. I don't know. I mean, you know, if something is for you personally, if it's, you know, this black box sitting here, it's a black box.
Sure.
And that's what it is.
Yeah.
I guess you can believe in that, you know.
Or not.
You can have different levels of that.
Right. But what you're saying is that there are practical tools, but then there's, you know, the mythology of aliens, right?
This is another thing, the whole 10% thing, the whole thing. I have never, ever heard of aliens in Scientology. And I've been a Scientologist all my life, and I've done a lot of courses and a lot. I have never heard of aliens in Scientology.
No?
Never.
No Thetans?
Please. Well, no, that's not an alien.
Okay.
No, the concept of a Thetan comes from this notion of what's called Theta.
Okay.
Right? And the idea of a Thetan is essentially the person. It's,
right, right.
It's the Scientology term for spirit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's just different language. yeah. really, about some of the same things that, you know, all religions deal with.
Exactly.
I get it.
You got it.
I'm set. I'm all set. You've demystified the whole thing for me. It's just people. It's just people doing a thing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it really is. It's based, you know, it started with a book called Dianetics.
Yep.
1950, and that had some things to say about the mind. And they're really interesting. I mean, it's really...
What did you think of that movie? You know, with Philip Seymour Hoffman.
I thought Joaquin Phoenix was an amazing performance in that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
I think...
The Paul, master.
Yeah, Paul Thomas Anderson, I think they were trying to say that it wasn't about Scientology, but come on. I mean, it was, you know, it was what it was. And I don't know. I think it was based on a book that somebody wrote who had a problem with Scientology.
Uh-huh.
And it's from that perspective, and
yeah,
and that's what it was.
That's where you see it.
Yeah.
Well, L. Ron Hubbard was just a guy.
Yeah.
And he had his own struggles.
Of course.
And that's documented within Scientology literature as well.
Sure. Yeah. Of course. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, again, it just comes back to he had some interesting things to say that work for me on a personal level.
And that's that.
And that's it.
And is there any way that does any of it apply to your acting?
Yeah, I don't know.
What
is
the idea? The idea of clear. What is that idea?
So, there's a 500-page book on the idea of clear. Called Dianetics. And if you, I mean, it would be hard to sit down and talk about
that. You can't summarize
that.
It for me?
No.
God damn it.
I don't think I can.
Come on, Giovanni. No. I'm relying on you to just make it simple so I can just process it and move along. Because in my mind, you know, like if you're really clear, that would like free you up to do
something. You read books, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see.
I might even have Dianetics around.
Well, what are you doing?
I have a lot of books.
If you want to know what, that's the other thing. I mean, if you really do want to know what the idea, you can disagree with it.
Right.
You know,
but okay. You're right. I mean, I got to take some time and just get in it.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's probably a synopsis in the book.
You know, no, and I'm curious because I fall victim to generalizations. About it. I don't know about it. I don't know that I've ever talked to somebody who was in it. And yeah. I'm a Jew. Uh-huh. I mean, that's as strange to some people as anything else.
Yeah, sure. I guess so.
But
yeah. So yeah, I mean, you know, I think I'm past that thing. You know, I grew up with people literally yelling at me because I was standing outside one of the organizations one day,
right.
I think, and a guy rode by on his bicycle and he, you know, hey, do you do that? And then he started screaming at me. I know it was just the most random thing. And then of course, you know, obviously certain movies like The Master and you know, whatever culture. And again, it comes back to me and looking at something and going, God, I just, that's not my experience with it. With Scientology, it's a personal thing,
right? And you feel like, but you feel spiritually grounded in general. You have that faith in your life.
No, absolutely not. But that's not. I think that's just sort of a natural thing with anybody, possibly. Yeah, yeah. I wouldn't associate. I wouldn't. That's a different conversation than Scientology.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It
for
is.
Me.
Your existential discontent is a different conversation.
Yeah. Like I said, I'm the most negative person I've ever met. No.
So when you say you work with, you know, you've worked with a lot of directors, and obviously that one guy spoke in your head when you were a kid, and you know, but you know, there like the one performance that killed me that I found to be like that I can't get out of my fucking head is The Gift.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
That was that Sam Raimi directed.
Sam Raimi, yeah, yeah.
And that character of the guy who, like, finally loosens his abuse memory and
yeah.
The rage of that fucking thing. I mean, you know, that was years ago. I mean, about how old were you when you did that role?
25, I think. 25 years old.
And that was a fucking mind-blowing role.
Oh, yeah, thanks, yeah.
Now, when you do something like that, when you invest those emotions in a character like that, does it, you know, maybe this is a naive question, does it fuck your head up?
It can. Or at the time I was thinking about things, and you're dealing with such a difficult subject matter,
right?
You know, and violent.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I look at that and I go, you know, maybe I could have, maybe I went too overboard with certain things and could have been a little bit more refined in the approach. But there was this sort of thing of just being precipitous about it and just wanting to be completely raw, you know,
right.
and as just sort of an experiment, really.
Is that the rawest you've ever gotten?
No, man. What are you talking about? No, I don't know. I don't know if that's the rawest I've ever gotten. But you know, I mean, and then there was another movie I did right after that with Kate Blanchett called Heaven. And that was a whole different thing. That was a lot more, I guess, reserved. And that was hard. That was just on a practical level because, you know, it's learning Italian, being in Italy and having to speak Italian with an Italian accent and all that. And there were just everything has. But that was probably for me one of the more difficult things. And psychologically, you know, not on the screen, but just sort of back at the hotel room.
How did you approach that? I mean, did you get a dialect coach?
Yeah, and I remember. I mean, it was really hard. I begged to be in the movie, and I stalked the director.
Who directed it?
Tom Tickfer.
Uh huh.
I remember I was doing a press junket for a movie, and then I went to I flew down to Torino where I knew the movie took place, just to sort of, and I didn't have the part, but I just went down there, and coincidentally I had an email and I said, I'm in Torino, I'm in a hotel room in Torino. to the director, and I really actually didn't know that he was there, and he said, oh, I'm in the lobby or something like that. Yeah. Maybe he was on the phone and then I just came downstairs and it was a total coincidence. And then after several weeks he said, "Okay, fine. You can do this role." And it was a whole nother thing.
Yeah. And you did the relationship that you had built with Cate Blanchett and The Gift, did that help your relationship on that movie?
No, I mean there was something really there was a lot of solitude, you know, I was kind of in my own bubble on mm-hmm. The Gift, mm-hmm. you know, really.
So you're really doing the method thing, kind of locked down?
The method thing, I don't know. I don't know what thing it was. It was the Ribisi thing.
Was it to maintain the emotional disposition of that character?
Yeah, and just to sort of try to, you know, I don't know, there's a certain sort of fabric there, I guess. I don't want to sound like a pretentious douchebag, mm-hmm. but there's a certain sort of... you know, a sort of an essence or something that you focus on, you know.
Because you get deep in it, man. And Saving Private Ryan, too. I mean, that character, like, what was it like to deal with that? Because that crew, were you guys close? Did you build a unity?
Yeah. Well, I was friends and I had already done several movies with Adam Goldberg.
Yeah.
Who's a terrific actor and an incredible director.
I'd like to talk to him. I feel
should, yeah.
I feel like we tweeted at each other or something.
Oh, you did?
I'd like to get in touch
with
him.
These are things now that you feel now that you don't even
yeah,
you
I don't
feel like you tweeted.
I feel like that we've like somehow or another, like I know, I think he wants to do the show or I, you know, he reached out. Or, like,
I'm sure. Yeah.
Shit,
yeah.
How's he doing?
I think you guys would go, it'd be gangbusters. He's doing great. He just finished a movie that he directed that he wrote called No Way Jose.
Are you in that?
No, but I was going to be involved in it behind the camera, sort of helping get things made. And then, And then, but he went off and made the movie, and I think it's going to be great. I don't know. I think they're editing right now.
Oh, man, I got to get in touch with him.
Yeah.
So you knew Adam, but so, what about the other guys?
Yeah, and then, you know, Vin Diesel and Barry Pepper and Jeremy Davies.
Yeah.
And I think the starkest memories of that film aren't necessarily... it's the boot camp experience that we talked about so much, and then we were asked about so much. But it was this thing where I remember we were Hampstead Heath, we were living in this field,
right.
behind this grove of trees, and they had everything. They were trying to make it as authentic as possible, with the, you know, the canvas tents and. And it did nothing but rain, and I remember I think we were like 10 days in, and we had to go get our work permits, and you know, I hadn't slept in 3 days, and my fingers were bleeding, and they were pruned, and I was starving and smoking 2 packs a day.
Oh, and God.
You're doing, you know, running 10 miles a day, and you have 40 pounds of rucksack on your back.
And this was at Spielberg's behest that you guys go through this?
Yeah, I mean, I think this was the second time it was done. The first time it was on a movie called Platoon. I could be off about that. But it was a guy, and a guy named Dale Dye. He was a colonel, but for some reason we were calling him Captain Dale Dye. And he kind of had a business out of this, you know.
He's an actor too, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a great actor, and he's a great person. So I think he was doing military boot camp, you know, and he had all different, you know, for all different epochs, and
right,
you know,
right, right,
the Roman army, and then also whatever.
Oh, really? That was
yeah,
just to get you guys into the place.
Yeah, you know, and I remember it was a challenge, and I remember we had to call each other by our character names,
mm-hmm.
and then there was at the end of the day there was I think a half hour or 1 hour where we would all sit by the campfire, and we wouldn't have to call each other by our character names, and we'd just talk, and it was kind of like this counseling, whatever,
right,
you know? and it was
like a group therapy thing.
Yeah, it was incredible. It was really this sort of bonding experience.
Interesting.
But I remember we got picked up. They said you need to do your paperwork, and you know, they had Wade and Upham,
mm-hmm.
and we had to get into a car, and there was a guy who had been on the first 5 days of the whole thing, and he disappeared, and by that point you haven't slept, you don't even know who's coming or going,
mm-hmm.
and he suddenly was there, and like, oh, what are you doing here? And then he said, you have to come with me.
Uh-huh.
So we go around these bushes, and we start walking, and he starts walking faster, and suddenly he starts whispering to us, and he says, you know, this is abusive, this is horrible, I've talked to production about this, and we are going to stop doing this, you guys are actors, and this and that, blah, blah, blah. We were like confused by it. Because I think at that point we had invested a sort of like a commit. We were committed to it, and we wanted to see it through.
You right,
know, this sort of extreme life. This sort of,
who was this person that was?
I forget. He was he was like a PA or something.
Oh,
like
really?
That. And he was going through the first 5 days with us, and then suddenly we come to a clearing after the bushes, and there's two parked Mercedes there,
yeah,
with drivers for us,
right?
And it was like, what the fuck is this? And suddenly, yeah, you're coming back to, you know, you're being stripped of your identity, the whole thing, and you're coming back. And then I remember I getting in the back of the car, just sort of like being told what to do, and get in the back of the car, and there was a woman in the passenger side of the front seat. And it was this most startling thing that, you know, we hadn't seen a woman in 10 days. And
yeah.
I remember Jeremy and I looked at, and we had the same thought. We looked at each other, and then we talked about it later, of course. And then, of course, you know, you go back and you eat McDonald's.
What
and
was
all
the
that,
thought?
That it was just like, holy shit, that's a girl. I mean, it really does become that primal. Uh-huh. That sort of feral sort of thing. Like, oh, oh, gola. No, and then we had to go to the mall, some, you know, British sort of suburban mall, get our picture taken, and then we snuck in McDonald's, even though we were told specifically go there, take a picture, and come back. And that's what that was. But by the end of it, I think that's the idea. I remember hearing about boot camp, and I don't want to pretend like I know anything about that, because we had 2 weeks, and boot camp is, I think, 3 months.
But you felt the effect of it stripping away.
Yeah, the idea that you strip away this identity of whoever you are to become something, or to be able to be something that is part of a bigger whole,
right?
You know, that can go and accomplish something or whatever that
so it was effective.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how effective it, I don't know. I mean, it was effective for the movie, and it was an experience that whether it was, you know, I mean, it was amazing. It was something that changed all of us forever, I think.
And working with Spielberg, was that a highlight of your life?
Oh my God, yeah, yeah. He's absolutely one of my favorite filmmakers. I was working with another director who said, you know, well, you know, he's Mozart and the rest of us are all Salieri's.
Uh-huh.
And it's amazing. Let's talk about having preconceived notions about somebody or mm-hmm. something. You know, this was his third movie that he was doing that year.
Right.
And I think he had Amistad and Jurassic Park before Saving Private Ryan. We were 2 weeks ahead of schedule on that battle sequence, which was
taking the beach.
Yeah,
yeah.
So that was 7 pages or 7.5 pages in the original draft, the shooting draft of the script. And usually, you know, one page in a script is a minute long. And
right.
I remember, I think that sequence is like 27 minutes or something like that.
That is one of the most insane.
Yeah, and
20 minutes of cinema ever.
I think we had 3 weeks blocked out for it, or 4 weeks.
Yeah.
And he was, I remember hearing he was 2 weeks ahead of schedule. Usually on something like that, you're halfway through making it and you're 4 weeks behind.
Right.
You know, on something. But he's just an amazing person and filmmaker, and it's just coursing through his body, his blood, you know.
And how did he deal with you as an actor? Like, what was his engagement?
It wasn't this precious notion that people, I think, you know, he talks about just hiring people who know how to do their job,
or right,
who are right for their job.
Right.
And I don't think he, rightfully, I don't think he wanted to get into what somebody's motivation was.
Right.
I think he says, you know, in order to tell this story, we need to be here and you need to be looking there and you need to say this and this whole thing. And you have to work that out, and I agree with that. I think that's, you know, he lets people do their jobs.
Have you
know?
Dealt with directors that don't do that?
There are directors that will literally come up to your face and move your chin, you know, 15 degrees to the right, and then hold it there, and you know, and it become, you know, yeah.
And
I've worked with people like that.
Keep it there.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're just supposed to say your line, you know, to each his own. And I must say that I have a certain amount of respect for that guy as well.
Yeah.
Especially if they're making good movies.
Right, sure. I guess as long as it's not intrusive and makes you mad.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly.
So now, given that you can go to the depths of darkness, and now you know, now you're in this huge comedy, and you've done two comedies with McFarlane.
Yeah.
Do you approach it differently? Is it a relief? Do you like getting laughs?
I love Seth MacFarlane. He's just someone that I feel like I connect with, and that I can relate to. And he's and talk about, you know, again, also, you know, somebody that I have respect for who's wearing so many different hats so masterfully.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this was also just that thing where we, you know, where it's like, holy shit, a Western going to Santa Fe.
Yeah.
From Albuquerque. And being able to do that, to make a Western out there on the Bonanza Creek Ranch.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It was really great.
It was a good time.
Yeah.
You know, the first, like, I didn't see Ted in the theaters, and it's been on cable.
Okay,
and I picked it up.
Yeah.
Like, I locked in because, like, I was, yeah, like, not put off, but I'm like, it's about a bear. But then I, like, start watching it, and I spent a lot of time in Boston.
Yeah.
And I love that
yeah,
tone.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I lived there for years.
Yeah.
And, like, I watched half of it, you know, I was like, holy shit, it's hilarious.
Yeah, I think it's really funny. Yeah, it's also Alex Sulkin and Wellesley Wild who are
I just talked
co-writers.
To Alex. I just talked
oh
to Alex.
You did, yeah. Oh great.
It's
yeah,
great.
Yeah,
yeah, it's great.
They're, you know, and I've worked with them on other and they're just, they're, it's the whole team. They're it's really good storytelling. It's not just, you know, what people sometimes people say, fart jokes and things like that. There's layers, you know, to their to,
but you like doing comedy.
Yeah, I mean, I think I like doing, I don't know if I have a caveat in that way as far as genres, or,
right,
you know, but I do like to try to do things that for me personally on a subjective or existential level might be challenging and some, you know, things that I haven't necessarily, or for me that I don't feel comfortable in.
Right.
You know? And it's totally selfish. It's not, it has nothing to do with, you know, fucking career move or anything like that.
You only make decisions. It doesn't matter if it's comedy or drama or whatever. It's just a matter of whether you're interested in the material.
Yeah, and it has a lot to do with the people that are involved,
right,
which is so important because you go and you not only are you sort of identifying yourself with that person or that cinematographer or whoever it is, the other actor or whatever, it's living with them
sure. For months.
Yeah, for months. And in what sometimes is extremity is, you know, relatively speaking.
Sure. So. I mean, especially if you got to go to boot camp.
Sure. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right. One last question that, like, I don't know if you can field it, but it just snapped into my head.
Mm-hmm.
Back to the Scientology thing quickly.
Mm-hmm.
What is the fundamental problem with psychiatry?
It goes back to, I think, the history of psychiatry. I think that and I do personally have, I mean, there's psychiatry and there's psychology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you were performing things like lobotomies,
sure,
on people and, yeah, saying that's helping them,
right,
by sticking a spike through their eyeball,
right,
into their brain and,
right,
moving it around violently,
right,
or electric shock treatment.
Sure.
Or even, and this is my own personal belief that I share with Scientology, I,
yeah,
should say, that Scientology hasn't necessarily influenced me on, but pharmaceutical companies and pushing drugs and having chemists and, you know, I mean, I've read so many books on what they do to market a drug.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the effects of certain drugs. And that, it's not the entirety of the practice of psychiatry and psychology.
Right.
I think at the end of the day, Hubbard would say, hey, if it helps you, great.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think it's just, it's more or less against certain practices that are specific
in altering the personality or destroying the mind.
Yeah, I mean, I see somebody who might have a problem,
right,
and they, whether it's, you know, extreme problems,
right,
and these are things that Scientology doesn't deal with and won't make that pretense,
right,
but, you know, schizophrenia,
right,
or certain things like that where I remember, okay, so here I have a personal familial example where my uncle,
uh-huh,
in the 1950s was caught in the back of a pickup truck with another man.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandfather, who I never met, on my, this is my mother's side,
yeah,
of the family, grabbed him and dragged him down to a whorehouse,
uh-huh,
and made him fuck a hooker.
Right.
And after that, he tried to commit suicide. And I guess it was state law in Florida at the time that if you tried to commit suicide, you had to have electric shock treatment.
Uh-huh.
And I go, how do you... I through my mother, you know, she would tell me things that he would talk about. I think it was several times, you uh-huh know? And this did not help this person. This did not, you know, take those feelings away. I mean, you kill so much, you know.
Sure.
That's more specifically about it. It's another large topic and hard to answer within.
Right, but the basic feeling is that you should be able to at least apply your own tools or whatever to overcome these, what might be thought of as you know, not necessarily psychological things that need to be treated per se.
No, I think that sometimes things need to be treated.
Okay.
Somebody experiences a loss in their life and then they're going through a hard time.
Yeah.
And then their doctor, within 10 minutes of meeting the person, this is the average of how long it takes for somebody to be prescribed. At one point it was Prozac, and then mm-hmm that fell out of fashion, and then, you know,
sure,
Adderall.
Mm-hmm.
And within 10 minutes, the person's taking psychotropic drugs.
Right.
And there's definitely a part of me that goes, well, what's the difference? Oh, the only difference for me personally are, you know, chemists sitting in a laboratory for years, pouring over, doing experiments and clinical trials with the drugs to make sure that they, you know, whatever, they're timed out. But as far as difference from cocaine or sure heroin or, you yeah know, or other, but a lot of them have the same chemical makeup. And I go, there's got to be a different way to deal or to have this, that this person experienced a loss and suddenly they have a chemical imbalance.
Right. No, I understand what you're saying.
I don't, and then you go, well, these are multi-billion-dollar industries. I mean,
that are looking for
Pfizer is $32
right
billion.
And they're looking for a way in. They're looking for new customers.
And
so
there's marketing there.
You're right.
And you when you go, oh, I've run businesses before.
Sure.
It's a different.
No, I get it. You know, I get it. Because, like, look, I'm a guy that's got nervous problems. I got anxiety. I got, you know, other issues, but I don't like the idea of medication. There's some part of me that thinks, like, well, maybe there's a way to look at things differently, to
yeah
apply a different discipline, to make different choices that'll perhaps, you know, make it manageable.
Yeah, I mean, I do have to say, I don't want to sound like I'm making a generality. Yeah, I think we all go through that.
Mm-hmm.
We experience emotions. It's life. It's livingness.
Right.
And I think that the people, a lot of people that I've talked to who say, oh, well, you know, but sometimes people just can't deal with that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like there's a similar sort of thing where it's a justification where that same person has had a drug problem before and they're mm-hmm trying to find another way to serve that addiction.
Sure.
I don't know. That was a specific instance.
No, I know what you're saying.
I mean, whatever. Yeah. It's, and again, that's a personal view, and I don't have any criticism for somebody who has the exact opposite view.
But psychologically, you're generally, you feel pretty good other than being negative all the time.
No, that's the point. I don't feel, but I guess to a greater or less degree, there's a part of me that's okay with that and not going to go, you know, take lithium.
Yeah, you have some self-acceptance around it.
I don't know. Fuck. I don't fucking know.
Well, you do great work, and I appreciate you coming here.
that's a part.
Is that it?
Okay, good. There we go. Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Is it?
I enjoyed talking to you, man.
Was that an awkward closer?
No. It's like, well, we could say at least he does good work.
No, that's not true. I think it's like, I think that it's interesting that, you know, that there's this, look, we all find some way to, whatever we ground ourselves in is what it is. It doesn't forego any other problems or that life is difficult or that we're negative or anything else. You know, that's just the part of
yeah
it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
And you bring it to your work. I mean, fuck. I mean, there's gotta
be. I would say that was a big thing. And I guess that's one of the things that's fallen out of fashion is, you know, funnel that into your creativity. You
right
know?
Right.
Or whatever. I don't
fight the fight.
Know.
No, no.
Right.
It's absolutely right, man.
Right.
Feel all right?
Yeah, thanks, man.
Well, that's it. Interesting guy. Diplomatic around some touchy subject matter. Didn't want to press him. Wasn't what the interview was about. Pow! I just shit my pants. JustCoffee.coop. Bobcat Goldthwait's movie is out. People are digging that. I don't know what Deaf Black Cat is. I'm a little out of sorts because of that. Boomer lives!